Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. During Advent, we are challenged in a special way to act justly, to love tenderly, and to walk humbly with our God. In today's program, we look at the way in which development in a developing country does not necessarily mean any benefits for the poor. Advent calls us to follow the Lord more closely. Later on in the programme, a poor Claire Collatine and I share our thoughts on our Franciscan way of life. As this is Advent, we will close with a brief reflection on Mary, the most beautiful woman the world has ever known, the one who followed the Lord to perfection. But first, Charles Collins now reminds us of the Pope's message from today's general audience.
Pope Benedict XVI on Wednesday received a portrait commissioned by the patron of the arts in the Vatican Museums. The portrait shows Pope Benedict seated on the famous papal throne of Leo XIII. The work was painted by Russian artist Natalia Zarkova. She has previously painted portraits of Pope John Paul I and Pope John Paul II. Pope Benedict received his portrait in a private audience after the weekly general audience in the Pope Paul VI Audience Hall. During his audience, the Holy Father spoke about St. Paulinus, Bishop of Nola, and contemporary of Saints Augustine and Ambrose.
In our catechesis on the great teachers of the early Church, we now turn to St. Paulinus, the Bishop of Nola in southern Italy. A native of Bordeaux in Gaul, Paulinus becomes a Roman governor of Campania, where, after encountering the depth of popular devotion to St. Felix, martyr, he was led to embrace the Christian faith. After the tragic loss of their first child, he and his wife sold their goods and undertook a life of chastity and prayer. Ordained a priest and then bishop of Nola, Paulinus distinguished himself by his charity to the poor during the troubled times of the barbarian invasions. A man of letters and a gifted poet, Paulinus placed his art at the service of Christ and the Church. In his poetry and his vast correspondence, Paulinus expressed his deep faith and his love of the poor. His letters to such contemporary churchmen as St. Ambrose, Augustine, Jerome, and Martin of Tours reflect his asceticism, his deep sense of the Church's communion, and his cultivation of the practice of spiritual friendship as a means of experiencing that communion within the mystery of Christ's mystical body enlivened by the Holy Spirit.
After his catechesis, the Pope took time to greet the pilgrims in various languages. I'm Charles Collins.
Responsible living in a developing country often means asking crucial questions that do not receive ready answers from those in authority. Jesuit Father Pete Henriot speaks of some of the major issues confronting Zambian society today.
Some work in the morning, some work up to midday, some work all day long.
The new mines that are opening up, because there are some new areas opening up in the northern part of the country, they're owned by foreigners or so, and the Canadians, the British, Indians, others, South African investors. But in some of these areas, they are constructing housing for the workers.
On the world market, the price of copper is soaring. There's great wealth in mining, but who is it who receives the money? It is certainly not the miners, who often live in appalling conditions. Investment in trade makes millionaires, but what about those who are at the mercy of the multinationals? How can anybody buy food when they are systematically impoverished? How can orphans and street kids create a stable future when they do not know what it is to have a home and a family? These are only a few of the questions that the Jesuit Center for Theological Reflection, based in Lusaka, Zambia, is trying to address. Its director, Father Pete Henriot, was in Rome recently for a meeting celebrating the 40th anniversary of the watershed encyclical, Populorum Progressio. He says more.
Now, when the mines were owned by the government, housing was constructed, and it was family housing. Today, some of the housing being constructed for workers is single-man hostels. This is the South African model. This is the creator of conditions of HIV and AIDS or so. And an incredible sort of a thing, that a company would come in and say, we're making lots of profit, we'll set up some housing, but no attention to the social condition.
So it's actually forcing the men into
situations.
Using prostitutes
into
as well.
Into situations that are just unacceptable or so. Yeah. So, I mean, that is a serious issue. It's one of the issues that's being faced, you know, has to be faced in terms of Zambia and the role of development. But just talking about the mines, the Catholic Commission for Justice and Peace, cooperating with Christian Aid, which is a British development group, with a professor from Oxford and a professor from the Copperbelt University in Kitwe, near the mines, released a study about 8 or 9 months ago called For Whom the Wind Falls. And it was basically a study and analysis of the sale of the mines in the 1990s and the conditions of the contracts of that. They were secret agreements. They weren't known by the public. They weren't approved. The government owned the mines. They were obliged to privatize, to sell them off, by the IMF and World Bank Renewal Program, Economic Reform Program. But these mines were sold off under conditions that only now have become available because this research has uncovered the secret agreements, published them, put them on a website, everybody can read them, put out a book that members of Parliament, I remember one member of Parliament just being shocked. He said, we had no idea what was going on. For example, the standard royalty paid on profits for mining, say in Chile or a place like that, would be a 3%. These mines were contracted for 0.6%, and that is what is being paid today, although the price of copper has skyrocketed. The price of copper is just tremendous. It means that some of these companies came in and bought the mines at a very low price. Within 2 years, the price of copper was going up. They were making millions, billions, and still paying the 0.3% royalty or so, 0.6% royalty. So there's been a major effort to say, you know, if you're going to have development, the rich resources of the people have to be paid attention to, but also the richness that should come from the resources that are Zambian minerals should also come to the people.
Yes, but with that income, you've got the development of beautiful new shopping centres. Mm-hmm.
And,
really
and
lovely
big
ones.
Big homes in Lusaka, mansions being going, which I'm saying is that that's why the civil society groups, these are, you know, church groups like our Justice and Peace, like our Jesuit Center for Theological Reflection, trade unions, women's groups, students groups, human rights groups are saying to the government and to the wider development community, international community, you've got to pay attention to the people, to participating in the development.
Or, yes, because these shopping centres,
people
the
from
thing
the
that
compounds,
always struck me, people in the compounds could not buy a single item on sale.
No. I mean, it's just, you look, you don't see. Some of the shopping compounds are near where our offices are on the Great East Road, and within a 10-minute walk from where our offices are is Nombe compound, one of the poorest compounds in the city or so. The people from Nombe compounds are not shopping in the shopping malls there. Or they're going very early, some women, to buy bread at the bakery and then bring it back and sell it in the compounds at a higher price to earn a little bit of money.
But also some of the shops in those shopping complexes, it seemed to me, were set up for money laundering because you never see anybody in them buying anything.
I don't know about that. There's certainly a lot of attention to money laundering situations or so, drug situations, whatever. But what I thought you might be going to say is a good many of those shops, even in their architecture, reveal they're from South Africa. And the profits, the returns are going back to South Africa. We did a study last year at our center on a really serious problem in terms of employment called casualization of labor. I hire you for 3 months, and then I fire you. The next day I hire you again, and then I fire you after 3 months. And the next day I hire you again. Now, you may be a checkout clerk in the counter, or maybe stocking in the back room or something or other. You have a job, but you have no benefits, no vacation time, no gratuity at the end of contract, no medical care. You're just simply a casual worker. Now, that's going on in many of the shops, indeed going on in the mines. Indeed, even some government employees are doing that. So there's a challenge, because it's against the law. You have to, if you've been there for 6 months, you've got to be given some kind of a contract. But now what we've seen, and you know, not to generalize, because there certainly are some good South African investors, but we have seen a lot that come in, they get a tax break to set up something, they're there for 3 or 4 years, the tax holiday ends, they pull out. And they've been able to take the profits back home. They've given some jobs at what are the wages and what are the conditions. And they're not investing in the country in the long term because the concerns obviously are for the people back in South Africa.
Mm.
That's raised some, you know, some strong feelings.
Yes, but also because of the tax breaks, it means that the South African companies can charge lower prices than the Zambian countries
companies and drive them out of competition or so.
And they can take over the Zambian businesses. So it's actually putting Zambians out of employment. But at the same time, instead of using Zambian labor, say a fridge goes down or something like that, they'll fly somebody up from South Africa.
And often there's situations like that. And those are unfortunate because, I mean, basically, you know, there's two things. One is Zambians feel this a lot because Zambia was the leader of the frontline states in terms of the struggle to end apartheid or so. And so it sacrificed a lot. The infrastructure was bombed. The rail lines were cut. Zambia suffered a lot because of its moral stance against the apartheid regime in South Africa. So there's a kind of a feeling, well, the South Africans should be, you know, a little bit more benign or helpful towards Zambia. But the other thing is, we need to concentrate more on regional integration. And it's very difficult to integrate when you're kind of a poor country facing a very rich country, as South Africa, in comparison, is very rich or so.
But also, in Zambia, you've got an increasing number of street kids and orphans, partly as a result of the HIV/AIDS. When you have so many who are dependent on what they can find in the streets, what future does the country have?
One of the people who was talking about this said, you know, we're sitting on a time bomb, because what do you have when you have a generation of youngsters who, you know, grow up in those kind of conditions? If they live, what will they be? They were without education.
Without a family.
Without a family. They've learned a kind of a life of survival in the meanest sort of ways or so, and some of it crime-related or so, even as children. What sort of a future will you have when you have millions of those kinds of people as your citizens or so? They're not going to be politically active. They're not going to be educated, things like that or so. So it's a very serious question. You know, it's again, the picture shouldn't be painted that, you know, Zambia is just in terrible situations. It's got these tremendous potentials. It has tremendous problems. And the challenge of the government, the challenge of the church, the challenge of civil society is get the potentials applied to the problems rather than just letting a few people take advantage of the potentials and make a lot or so. So when you talk about the children, street kids, that's a tremendous problem or so. You talk about HIV and AIDS, that's a tremendous problem. You talk about a study by the government, Central Statistics Office, just in the past couple of weeks, that showed there had been a decline in the number, the percentage of the poor in urban areas, but an increase in the past couple of years of the poor in the rural areas. So the poor are those, World Bank says, living on less than a dollar a day. Now, Most people live on much less than a dollar a day, but it's kind of an average mathematical figure or so. And the figure was that 67% of the population of Zambia across the country was below that poverty line. That line has dropped somewhat in the urban areas in the past couple of years because of a lot of construction going on, these malls opening up, they're going to be hiring some people, things like that or so. So there's been a little bit movement. But in the rural areas, it has actually seen a decline. It has seen an increase in the number of those who are poor, the percentage.
Yes, because one of the problems that is found in Zambia and with other African countries as well, Zambia is landlocked, but you have some very big lakes like Lake Bangwelu mm-hmm. and Lake Mweru, and Kariba. Very, very mm-hmm. beautiful. Mm-hmm. But you've got people who have traditionally been fishermen, and now they're forced more and more into farming because the fishing is declining. Mm-hmm. With you coming to Rome to look at the effects of development in the light of Populorum Progressio, how do you tackle what is effectively a culture change?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing you pay attention to, and it is interesting, it was highlighted in Populorum Progressio, indeed even before it was begun to be highlighted in some of the big development agencies like the bank, is culture is a major factor in development. You have to pay attention to cultural patterns. You have to be sensitive to how the people are living in terms of meaning and values and family and customs, all kinds of things like that. And that wasn't always done when Western development experts came into a country like Zambia. So you've highlighted one thing. Actually, I was almost smiling when you were talking about earning money by fishing in so many of these areas or so. We've got still the major killer in Zambia is malaria. It still is the major killer. And so there's been a tremendous push for, you know, bed nets coming in. And they have done some very good things. One of the problems is bed nets are also very good fishing nets.
Absolutely, and they destroy all the fish.
And so you're catching all the small little fish, and that's why, as you mentioned, you're getting a decline in some of the fishing population or so. How do you get people who have been fishing all their lives and in their culture, that's what they know, to actually then turn to maybe planting maize or sorghum or maybe moving into a cash crop like sugar or something like that or so? It is a challenge.
Some work in the morning, some work up to midday, some work all day long. It is not how long we live, but what we do with our time.
The Franciscan Order has many different flowers in its garden. Sister Mary Juliana of Gethsemane, a poor Claire Collatine, and I, a Franciscan missionary of the Divine Motherhood, soon discovered that we were speaking the same language.
Assisi, I love your rolling fields, your flowers and silver streams that flow to the sea. Assisi.
We were two Franciscans speaking together about our reason for living. Sister Maria Juliana of Gethsemane is a poor Claire Collatine living in Harden in North Wales. I am a Franciscan missionary of the Divine Motherhood, currently based in Rome. Yet, although our lifestyles are so different, in fundamentals they are the same. And that is why Sister Juliana and I were, at the very deepest level, speaking the same language.
Paul VI said, "The Franciscan Order is the youth movement of the church." And it's true. We're a new religious movement. After 8 centuries, we're still a new religious movement. And if we're not, we're dead.
For me, two of the most precious images I have of Francis is one of him walking through the woods using the two sticks as a violin and a bow. And the other is of him supporting the church that was about to fall. A Franciscan life is very much a life of joy within the church and building the church from within. And this is very much the same for Poor Clares and Poor Clare Collatines as well.
In our chapter room, we have a homemade by local artists, meaning the community, model of St. John Lateran. And it's a box inside, and the roof has a lid in it. And under the front porch is St. Francis holding up the portico, and behind St. Francis is St. Clare holding up St. Francis. And inside this model of St. John Lateran's is a whole stack of pieces of card, several thousand of them, with short texts taken from the writings of Francis and Clare and from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And every day, the community sisters, when we begin work, dear Mother will come to the chapter room and we will pray. And dear Mother will open the lid of St. John Lateran's and dig in and pull out a text and read it. And that is a view to take on the day, so to speak. This morning's reading was from the Catechism, and it was about the joy of the Lord's return at the end of time in the Parousia. The novitiate also have a Bible box, and theirs was our earliest Bible box, but theirs is literally quotes from the Bible. And unlike the community, where there's too many to do it, instead of there being one for all of us, each of the novitiate sisters takes out a Bible text and reads it with her sisters at the beginning of the day, and with their mother as she goes to the novitiate. Our life is a new approach to human existence. In our family, if a person comes to join our way of life, to seek God in our way of life, there are no requirements, as there would be in a nursing order or a teaching order. There are no requirements, I should say, on that level. There is one requirement: willingness. And into that willingness, for a person to come, there must be the call of the Lord and the answer, yes, of the person. For that person to grow in the Spirit, to live in the heart of the Church, there must be the seed of God's call, but there must also be the matrix of the community. Almost in the sense of when a human child is conceived, the child will not live if there is not the wall of the womb for the child, for the seed to implant itself into. And that is another interpretation of this wonderful heart of Clare's rule, that a sister must love and nourish her sister as a mother would love and nourish her child of the flesh. She must spiritually make the community a place of growth. Together, it must be a place of life and growth in the Spirit.
Because the Franciscan vocation, in all its different manifestations across the world, is first and foremost a call to community, and a community that's centered on God.
Our life is a community life. Our life is a family life. And so few of us have experienced family on the ordinary level, that this is very precious to us.
Assisi, you'll always be home to me. You're part of my destiny.
How could we in Advent not give Mary the last word? We close with a brief reflection on the one who carried the word within her and whose title of Woman of Faith sums up her whole life. She was the most beautiful woman the world has ever known, but her loveliness was not something that would cause people to stop in their tracks to watch her walk by. No, her beauty lay within, hidden from those who didn't have the eyes to see or a heart open to respond to the beating of hers. She was a young girl in an obscure village, pregnant before she married the local carpenter. Almost nothing that she ever said or did has been recorded. And yet, 2,000 years after she gave birth to her son in a stable and laid him in a manger, Mary's name is still treasured. People have lived and died with her name on their lips. She has been portrayed in some of the greatest works of art ever to have been created. Yet, the one who occasioned such devotion lived and died as a simple village woman. Mary was created by her son to be a mother, to be his mother, to be our mother. And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.